And welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Sean.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Well, happy Valentine's Day to you. And joining us a little later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Sally Rose will call in. She's with the Provincetown Banner. She's the editor there. And we'll hear from Joshua Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. So let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the Islands. Sean, let's start off with Senate President Therese Murray. She won't seek a 12th term. I don't think that was a big surprise for some who pay close attention, because she was going to lose her presidency.
In March, she was going to lose the gavel there as the Senate president, and decided that, you know, it'd be a good time to step down after 22 years on Beacon Hill. She's been in the Senate for a long time and was, of course, the first woman to serve as Senate president. And, you know, arguably the way the state legislature set up with a veto-proof majority in both the Senate and the House, a lot of people say that, you know, really the governor is the third most powerful person in the state, that really the House Speaker and the Senate president are the most powerful politicians in the state. And Senate President Therese Murray being, you know, representing this particular district, is it's significant for this district to lose someone with that kind of clout on Beacon Hill.
The stories in the paper this week in the Cape Cod Times reference specific examples of how Senate President Murray really helped send some money to the district and support issues that she felt were important, and including issues the governor felt were important. I'm thinking of the MMA.
The MMA is a great example. And in fact, I spoke with Admiral Rich Gernon over there earlier this week, and he said that, you know, everybody calls it MMA, Mass Maritime Academy, but in some ways he was only half joking when he said it could be called the Murray Academy. And he just was referring to the advocacy that she really put forward for the college there. And, you know, one story that he told me was that, well, in addition to, you know, various money that they got, that one of the triggers he thought was a few years ago, the governor came to speak at one of the graduations. And Admiral Rich Gernon made sure that he sat next to Senate President Therese Murray. And as he described it to me, he said that she really worked him over in terms of
the governor.
The governor, meaning, yeah, she knew, of course, that the governor wanted to invest in some of the state colleges, and so Therese Murray, according to the, Admiral Gernon, said that you know, Governor, here's your chance. You know, there's certain types of behaviors you want to see in schools, and this is a perfect example. The kind of stuff they're learning here is the kind of, you know, the economy that you'd like to build, and you need to invest, and so some of the big investments that really rolled out of the governor's administration, the first two were Bridgewater State University and MMA. And so, you know, that included money for that. It was used to be the library, but it's this info center now, and it's really sort of a high-tech building. That was, $30 million bucks or something like that for that. And then also the wind turbine there, she was instrumental in bringing money to install that wind turbine there. So it's just one example, and there were many, you know, that go from the range of, you know, some of the high political issues to even some of the sort of smaller constituent issues. And so, and you know, Randy Hunt I spoke with, and he put it well, I think.
He's a
state representative for Sandwich, and, you know, part of his district, of course, overlaps with hers. And, you know, State Rep Randy Hunt really said that it really does matter to have, the Senate president representing your district. And he says, you know, I've got to believe that there are certain bills that move faster through the process with someone like that in your corner. And, of course, you know, the Senate president really controls the legislative agenda on the Senate side. So
certainly. And she took that presidency in 2007. And as we mentioned, term limits for the presidency would have made her have to give up her gavel. There was some discussion in the paper where she said that some folks had floated the idea at the State House that perhaps she could put aside that rule and hold on to the presidency. She wasn't willing to do that. Seems like a wise idea. And over the years, of course, she was known really for all her human services and social services work, mm-hmm, as well as more recently really working on reorganizing the troubled probation and trial court departments.
You know, absolutely. And there's also some, you know, going into the, you know, sort of the end of her career here, she's really going to be focusing on this minimum wage bill to raise the minimum wage and also reforming unemployment insurance. In fact, I think she's tasked State Senator Dan Wolf, who's on that committee, to revamp that. And so those are going to be her two main, I think, legislative focuses as, you know, she ends her career.
Let's move on from politics. We'll probably return to it, but let's start with there was an incident with the fire department that they brought up. On Tuesday, they responded to an early morning fire, 3 o'clock in the morning, to find out that the closest fire hydrant was frozen. I understand that this is not a common thing that happens, but it happens just enough to cause concerns. And of course, the fire department's are asking homeowners to take a look at the hydrants around their own homes.
Right. I think what they're asking is to clear off some of those hydrants. And it could be big. I mean, you mentioned this fire in Yarmouth that happened at 3 a.m. And as you mentioned, you know, these frozen fire hydrants don't happen very often. But if you lived at that house on 27 Bliscott Avenue, once is enough, right? So in that particular case, it took them another 5 minutes because they had to find another fire hydrant over there on Route 28, which was really hundreds of feet away. So, when you're talking about fighting fires, of course, every minute is precious.
That 5 minutes could be the deciding factor between whether you save a house or not.
That's right. That's right. And it wasn't just in Yarmouth. There were a couple of other incidences. In Chatham, firefighters had some problems with a fire hydrant that they thought was frozen, but actually there was this worn down part, not the ice. And so in that instance, it was a maintenance issue. And then in Falmouth, there were a couple of fires where there was a fire hydrant steamer cap that had been frozen shut.
Right. That's the main cap that the firefighters first go to get water.
Right. And so in most instances, I believe water districts are who maintain fire hydrants. And as you said, you know, this isn't something that's sort of a widespread phenomenon. But in months like January and February, when it gets particularly cold, these type of things can happen. And so in essence, you know, some of the fire department said, you know, hey, you know, if you see a fire hydrant buried in snow, do us a favor, do the neighborhood a favor, really, and dig it out. I mean, it could really matter.
Let's talk about the Lowe's that has been proposed for Dennis. That was swatted down by the Cape Cod Commission, the regional regulatory authority, just a few weeks ago. But it doesn't seem to be going away, not only on the editorial page of the newspapers, including the Cape Cod Times. Mm-hmm. But now we hear that Lowe's is going to land court.
And this was they had 30 days to file this appeal. And the day before that 30-day time frame expired, they filed the appeal. I don't think it was a big surprise. You know, Lowe's is a massive company, and they really wanted to open a Lowe's in Dennis, and as do, you know, a number of Dennis officials. Of course, a lot of town officials had testified before the Cape Cod Commission on behalf of Lowe's, saying we'd like this project. Now, of course, there was this group, Say No to Lowe's, that was headed up by the president of the Old South Dennis Village Association. So there were a lot of sort of small businesses in Dennis and other parts of the Cape who, frankly, didn't want to see a Lowe's open, and primarily out of concerns that Lowe's would sink their businesses.
Yeah, they're worried about the lower prices. Mm-hmm. Some people are worried about the types of jobs that Lowe's
mostly part time, mm-hmm.
mostly part time, lower wage earning jobs. But of course, as you say, lots of people supportive, and now the it's coming down on the Cape Cod Commission, and this is a government body that is used to being.
Especially
attacked.
On big projects, sure, right. Sure. And you know, it's not like they have an unlimited budget, and so in some ways, I guess they have to pick their fights. And this was one I think that they were willing. And I would imagine that as the commission, but keep in mind as well that this was a fairly close vote. It was, I believe, 8-6 vote on the commission. The subcommittee had recommended they not approve it. It was a contentious debate, of course. And it was a close vote. And whenever you have something like this, particularly with a company that's really targeting an area that has the kind of legal resources that a company like Lowe's has, you can expect that there's going to be a fight. And, you know, my understanding, though, when it comes to decisions by local regulatory boards and, you know, even on to the level of zoning boards, that judges are not exactly that they tend to rule in favor of the local boards strictly because it's like, look, those are your rules, and essentially, as I understand it, and I'm not saying predicting the outcome of this case, but as I understand it, a lot of judges, what they look for is to see if there's sort of any sort of egregious violation of that body's own rules.
Right.
And short of that, they often rule in favor of the regulatory board. So that would seem to indicate that, you know, and I think, you know, we had a quote from Ken Foster, who was the head of the Say No to Lowe's group. And he said they certainly have the right to appeal. But he thinks that it's going to be quite formidable, he said, for that to happen. So, you know, it's one of these we'll have to wait and see.
I wasn't around, but when my understanding is when we talk about Home Depot, a similar type of store that came to Hyannis, it had to find an existing building or area that could take a big box store like that. And some people are saying that same thing might have to happen to Lowe's. Rather than go to an area that hasn't been developed with this type of store, they might have better luck finding an already developed site. So we'll be paying close attention to that. I thought we were done with that story after several months of hearings, but I guess not.
No.
Let's talk briefly about a report this week about drug overdoses spiking across the Cape. This is just within the early part of this year. And of course, the Cape Cod Times has done tremendous reporting around the addiction problem here and about the relationship between painkillers, particularly opiates, which has led to this explosion of heroin use after decades of heroin really being pretty much underground and totally feared. Now it's back in full force.
That's right. And so there's been this string of heroin overdose recently in the past few weeks. And, you know, the Centerville, Osterville, Marston's Mills Fire District, Falmouth, Yarmouth, they're seeing 3 to 6 times higher number of overdoses during this particular part of the year than they were last year. In fact, I think something like already they've seen about 30% of what they saw all of last year. And so it is alarming. And there isn't there's a bit of a mystery here, actually, in that they don't know exactly what is leading to these various overdoses. There's been a couple of deaths. They're not exactly sure what is behind it. You know, sometimes when you have a string of overdoses, it can often be because it's a, you know, what they call, I guess, a bad batch of a drug.
Sure.
They're not necessarily seeing that. But I think what was interesting in the story is, and part of what I think is driving this, as you mentioned, people get addicted to these opiates and these painkillers. And so some folks are wondering if, you know, over the past few years, there have been some real sort of crackdowns on these pill mills, essentially. You know, a lot of the pills that were coming to the Cape illegally, that were being sold on the street, were coming from Florida. Well, Florida has really tightened up a lot of those laws. And what happens is you get addicted to these pills, and they're becoming more expensive, they're becoming harder to get. And then when you have that type of severe addiction, heroin becomes attractive because it's cheap and it's easy to get.
Right. So this is basically a synthetic form of heroin, these opioids. And so what happens is, yeah, people become addicted to them. And when they can't get them or they become more expensive, they become dope sick. If they don't take that pill anymore, they get that dope sickness that we've all heard about through withdrawal, when people withdraw. So they turn to something that's available, something that's cheap, and something that they can typically sniff up their nose and get a quick relief from that dope sickness, and that is heroin. And another point made in that article is really interesting. It's about this drug Narcan. Now, this is a drug that can be administered. For a long time, it was just administered by medical professionals,
right,
when someone overdosed, and it could wake them back up.
Within seconds, I understand it.
Exactly, within seconds. And recently, that drug, that Narcan, has been available to addicts and to addicts' families. So if someone overdoses, they can administer it right away, not have to wait for an ambulance or a firefighter or a police officer. More commonly, they're being carried in cruisers now. So that could skew the overdose numbers too. So perhaps even the numbers could be even higher.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, the state overdose education and outreach in Narcan, all that stuff is administered around here by the AIDS support group. So
right,
if people are interested in that drug, they should contact the AIDS support group and figure out if they can get trained in the use of Narcan. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll find out what's happening with the debris from Harwich High School.
The news roundup was recorded earlier today. We are not taking your phone calls this evening. You're listening to WCAI.
Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI, and we're discussing the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. On the phone is Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Morning, Sean. Doing fine, thanks.
Good. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk about this artificial reef off of Harwich. They may use this reef to put some demolition debris from Harwich High School.
That's correct. The reef has been in the planning stages for nearly a decade, and the state recently granted a waterways permit, allowing it to go forward. It's going to be approximately 2 miles off of Red River Beach in Nantucket Sound. It was initially part of a plan to extend an existing artificial reef off of Yarmouth. They wanted another site because that one was successful. But it couldn't come at a better time, like you said. Harwich High is due to be demolished this summer to make way for Monomoy Regional High School. And using demolition debris from the high school, things like concrete and plastic, inert material that would work as part of a artificial reef, that could save the demolition costs on the project. So they're serious examination of this right now, and fishermen are, I think, looking forward to having something a little closer by to go out and find some better fish out there in Nantucket Sound.
You mentioned, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but you mentioned that another reef has been deemed successful. Do you know how they gauge success?
Not sure about that.
Yeah.
I believe this one's been in place for quite a while off of Yarmouth, and I think they look at the community of the habitat that's created through the artificial reef, and you know how many new species come, and exactly you know how the fishing is out there. I think.
Did they? You mentioned plastic. We've done a lot of reporting around some concerns about plastics in the ocean. Were any of those concerns raised about plastics, or how they go through this material to make sure that they have? I don't know what.
They haven't really raised those concerns yet. They're still in the early stages. They're not sure exactly what demolition debris from the school might contribute to this reef. And they specifically said in the printed material about this reef that the material has to be inert. So I imagine they have to test the plastic, if they do indeed use plastic, to make sure that nothing's going to leach out.
Chatham novelist Lisa Genova, who's been on our station certainly many times, and she wrote the book Still Alice. That is a book about Alzheimer's disease. What's the news with Lisa Genova in that book?
Well, the news here is that, you know, of course, Lisa's story is a real local success. She started out self-published Still Alice, and, you know, the story of a Harvard professor dealing with early-onset Alzheimer's. It was picked up by a major publisher and became a New York Times bestseller. All along the process, Lisa told me that her agents told her, you know, we may have interest in movie rights. Don't get your hopes up, because nobody's going to make a movie about a 50-year-old woman with Alzheimer's disease. That turned out not to be true. Still Alice is now in pre-production. A London company called Neon Park Films optioned the movie, and they've signed Julianne Moore to star in the lead role. In supporting role right now, they've announced Kristen Stewart, Kate Bosworth, and Alec Baldwin. It's going to be about a $5 million production, scheduled to start filming in New York in March, actually.
Well, that's good news. There needs to be more discussion around Alzheimer's. It needs to be brought more into the mainstream and not just dealt with by people dealing with the disease and their caregivers. So this is excellent
sure.
news. Thanks for sharing that with us. I'd like to mention that folks can follow Tim and the Cape Cod Chronicle Newsroom on Twitter, at CCC Newsroom. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
You too. Sean Gonsalves is with me here in our Woods Hole studio. Sean, let's talk about a court case this week that was decided. Adam Finnegan has been convicted of setting a fire at Cape Cod Bible Alliance Church in Brewster.
That fire was in November of 2012, and it destroyed the entire church. And so, as you mentioned, he was found guilty. He's looking at possibly 10 years in prison. And what happened, though, after he was convicted, the judge, Christopher Muse, granted a request by his attorney for the psychiatric or clinical examination before he's sentenced. He's been being held at Bridgewater. That's where he's been this whole time.
It's the state hospital.
The state hospital. And so his attorney would like him another evaluation. And because there is this possibility that he could be essentially sentenced to Bridgewater for a period of time where you get this review every 6 months.
And that would be applied, his time spent, if he is indeed sent back to Bridgewater, that time spent there would be applied towards his overall sentence?
To his overall sentence. So we'll find out how long he's there. You know, this was a... I thought the story was moving in some ways. It was to listen to his parents who were there... It sounded like it was obviously difficult for them. You know, we quote them in the story saying, "We decided from the beginning to step back and let the justice system take its course." And they say it's such a shame that in order for him to get well, it had to be from such a horrendous event. And so it raises this question of the need for services, mental health services for a number of people, not to excuse what he did. And what was also interesting was that there were a number of members from the church that also attended the trial, and they were saying, including the pastor, saying that they were thankful for the verdict because, unfortunately, they felt like this verdict was something that needed to have happened in order for this to stop. And obviously, you know, for somebody dangerous to be taken off of the streets. And if in fact that he does need these mental health services, this is probably the way that he's going to get it. And that, you know, there's a tragic element there, I think. But nevertheless,
sure, of course, I mean, churches are so important in the community. Put aside, you're thinking about the religion itself, just the churches and communities and how they contribute to the communities and the supports that they offer. And people are so connected to them, and to have one burn, particularly one that has been burned by someone else, incredible. Upsetting.
That's right. You know, during the trial, his attorney tried to basically poke holes at the prosecution's case that he in fact set the fire. But of course, that argument didn't carry the day. There was some pretty striking evidence that would lead you to believe that he was in fact guilty of setting the fire.
It was an interesting story to follow, a trial to follow. There were some legal maneuverings that happened, and including the judge excluding evidence from his parents, and so as you were kind of following it, watching that process, but clearly took the jury, I think, 2 hours to come to a verdict there, so the evidence seemed to be overwhelming.
Mm.
Let's move on to a bit of a happier story. Researchers at the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies noticed a right whale, a mama right whale, is back in the area. And of course, we know there's only, 500 of these whales.
That's right.
Still around. So every single birth is important. And this whale, we remember from January of 2013, earlier this year, showed up in the bay with a newborn. A newborn calf, and then we saw that whale again in April with the calf, but this time no calf. But I understand that's pretty common.
Right. We shouldn't necessarily think that something happened to the calf, but you know, folks around here really love their marine animals, and particularly these right whales. They often give us some great shows. You know, sometimes coming around and feeding, and it's just a great area to live in to see that kind of wildlife. You know,
sure.
It's like living in an aquarium in some ways around here.
It's the world. Wart, this particular animal's name is Wart, and you know,
Wart. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
You make a good point. Well, this particular whale had been freed from entanglements over three different seasons. So they started working on it during one arrival of the whale, and then the next one, and then finally with the third arrival of the whale, they were able to get all of that entanglement off her. But you talking about having these whales around here, people should go to Cape Cod Online and read this story because of the insights there from representatives of the Provincetown Center for Coastal Studies. They're talking about how these whales are arriving at earlier in the season than ever before, and they're trying to figure out what that is. Is that climate change? Is that differences in the food sources? Not necessarily here. Is there more food here, or is there less food someplace else? But the real concern is, as we move forward in time, are the whales no longer going to be here? Are they going to have
move
to go
elsewhere,
someplace else?
Right, look in search of food or what have you. You're right.
Those same pressures could disrupt, you know, what is a significant area right now for these whales, and that is you know, the bay. Let's move on to it was a small story in the paper this week, but it's one we've been following. It's in regards to the Cape Light Compact and CVEC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these two groups we've heard a lot about. They promote renewable energy projects, but they've also been under a lot of scrutiny.
The compact was formed in 97, really, to buy power in bulk for electric customers, you know, on the Cape and the Vineyard. The cooperative was formed fairly recently in 2007 to develop these renewable energy projects. And so a lot of people have raised questions about the relationship between the two groups.
A lot of the same players.
A lot of the same
leaders
players.
Leaders in both groups. And money changing hands.
Exactly. And who and how these various renewable energy projects are funded. Some people point to the compact saying, look, you are designed to buy bulk electricity for customers at lower rates. And it turns out, I believe, that you know, if you're with one of the other power carriers, even I think even NSTAR, you might actually pay a little bit less. And so some people question the very integrity of the organization itself, basically saying you're not doing what it is that you were out, you know, you were set
up
to do.
That's true.
And then, but then there's this gentleman, Eric Bibler, who lives in Connecticut, but spends some time on the Cape. And he's been this engaged and really in this long running battle trying to get access to the various records and documents. And we should also point out that it's not just folks who are opposed, because Eric Bibler's a person who's opposed to wind energy and so forth. And so part of his thing is to try to expose these groups as sort of renewable energy frauds. But there are other people who, aside from the politics of renewable energy debate, think, listen, you still need to go by the books. Public access to public records is vital. And so when people were asking for these public records, they weren't quite getting the records that they were asking for in a timely manner. And furthermore, they were also be given these huge bills, you know, saying, well, if you want those documents, it's going to cost you, you know,
thousands.
Hundreds or thousands of dollars.
Eric Bibler, you mentioned him. Folks may actually know his name. You may receive his emails. He sends them out. He has an incredible email list. Every journalist on Cape Cod gets these emails. And we've
yep.
been watching this over the years as he's been requesting documents that appear to be public. Just based on our experience as journalists, these documents should be public. Some are financial documents. And he's received real difficulty and scorn in also from these requests. And so now we finally heard from the state ruling in most cases that he should have received these documents. He should have been able to see them, not at the cost that was estimated that he
right.
had to pay.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't looking for copies. He would take a digital copy, so you shouldn't have to photocopy anything. You still have to search for them. That takes time. So now we're hearing from the state, and I guess we're going to wait and see how CVEC and Cape Cod Light Compact react.
Right, because there will be some time for them, obviously, to respond. But as you said, the Secretary of State's Supervisor of Public Records essentially agreed with Mr. Bibler and sent letters to these agencies saying, listen, you've got to provide this information. And so how exactly that will play out, we'll have to find out. They do. I forget exactly the time schedule that they have, maybe 10 days or something like that. But I'm sure within the next week or so, we'll be on this program talking about this, the outcome of, you know, some of these records.
Sure, yes. Absolutely. Okay, let's talk about these new rules that are being proposed for oysters. Tough year when it comes to people getting sick by the bacteria, Vibrio P, I think it's called.
Vibrio P, right. We'll stick with just the P part because I can't pronounce the actual scientific term for it, but it's a serious illness. If you get it, you're going to get really sick. And last year, 58 people got sick in Duxbury and in Martha's Vineyard. It was this outbreak last summer. And this came after the state tried to come up with a plan to prevent that.
Yeah, things have been getting worse. Back in 2011, 13 people got sick. 2012, 27. And as you said, this past year, in 2013, 58 people getting sick. And what happens when someone gets sick? The state can come in and shut down an entire entire beds, entire fisheries, entire towns.
Right. And so not only is there this big economic impact for fishermen, from a tourist standpoint of view also, particularly in an area that really bills itself as a place that has great seafood, this you don't want to have this. You don't want to have people coming from all over and going back to wherever they came from with stories about how, oh, yeah, that Cape Cod seafood made me sick.
Oh, no.
So we can't have that.
And so what are they doing? What are these regulations?
So they want to come up with these stricter regulations. And so they came up with a half a dozen or so that they're hoping are really going to wipe this problem out. More precise record keeping, in detail, the time of icing. They want to have standardized icing procedures that quantify exactly how much ice is used, where it's placed. Now, the ice, we should also mention, it doesn't kill the bacteria, but it can slow down the process.
The reproduction.
And so that's why there's such an emphasis on the timing of the icing. And then there's some other things about standardizing, the closure of some of these beds and how long they should be. And also they're setting some criteria for farms to reopen that involve some sampling and so forth. So they're starting to get really into the weeds, I think, and want to really wipe this out altogether.
We'll pay attention to that, see how it works as the season progresses. Josh Bolling is on the phone. He's the assistant editor of the Inky Mirror, the Inquirer and Mirror in Nantucket. He's as well as the director of digital content at that paper. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Big talk in town, new Stop and Shop.
Looks like it. Stop and Shop has applied to the planning board to build a new 38,000-square-foot supermarket on the site of its current store between Pleasant Street and Sparks Avenue. This store is slightly bigger, about 6,000 square foot on the ground bigger, but with 14,000 square feet of storage space inside between Pleasant Street and Sparks Avenue. They had their first official presentation of the store on Monday night before the planning board. The planning board had some questions about loading and unloading traffic flow, but generally appeared favorable. It's pretty generally acknowledged on Nantucket that the store is undersized, the parking is not sufficient, and they don't have the space to provide the items that both year-round residents and summer people are looking for, and they say that this new design, moving the supermarket from the west side of the parking lot to the east side near the Nantucket Fire Department, will allow for a larger store and more parking spaces. Yeah, this application is going to go on for a little while, probably two or three more months at least, I would imagine. They say they can get the store built in 8 to 9 months. They'll keep the existing store open. There's another smaller Stop and Shop downtown, but those are the grocery stores on Nantucket right now. A couple of neighbors came out to express some concerns about traffic safety, and the fact that they hadn't been consulted with the plans yet. They say they're going to meet, Stop and Shop officials will meet with those neighbors and any others that are concerned to lay out their plans and explain what they're hoping to do out here.
So the Stop and Shop is in front of the planning board. Meanwhile, an erosion project on Nantucket has gotten called onto the carpet. What's happening with that?
It has. This is the erosion control project out on the east end of the island, trying to protect the Sconset Bluff from erosion from the waves that pound the base of Baxter Road, one of the most affluent and beautiful, scenically beautiful neighborhoods on the island. The town and the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund have received permission back in December to do an emergency project out there to put really massive geotextile bags filled with sand at the base of the bluff to break up the waves before they hit that land and attempts to really protect the homes and property above and the road itself. But the Conservation Commission voted 6-0 last Wednesday to issue an enforcement order to the two groups for unpermitted work they say was done as part of that project. They say that there was some PVC piping installed along the coastal bank, drilled into the bank for drainage issues, that some concrete was used to plug up the geotubes that were filled with sand. Some excavation work was done below the mean high water mark, which is a big no-no.
Yeah.
That sand was placed on the coastal bank outside of permitted areas. The SBPF says, no, that's not the case. Some of this stuff was allowed by the emergency approval. Some of it didn't happen the way they say it did. They'll be back next Wednesday to further explain themselves. And right now, no penalties or fines being levied. And the project itself, the emergency part anyway, is essentially done. But I don't think this is over by any means.
And Josh, tell us about the feature that you have for Valentine's Day today. I just love the what you're calling it, Love on the Rock.
We call it Love on the Rock. We're Nantucket Love Stories. We talk to five different couples out here of varying ages, young and young at heart, about how they met, whether they met on Nantucket or brought their love stories to Nantucket, and how they make romance and love work on an island 30 miles out to sea where everything sometimes, as beautiful as it is, might be a little more difficult than it can be on the mainland. And we've gotten a great response to it. We actually solicited visited a number of the couples online. They told us their stories, and we put them in print. We got their pictures, and right now it's really generating a lot of positive buzz here on Valentine's Day.
Oh, that's great. Folks can go to, of course, the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror website to see that story and other stories. And Josh, of course, is the assistant editor of the Inky Mirror, as well as the director of digital content at the paper. You can also follow Josh on Twitter, jballing at INKYM for Inky Mirror. And thank you very much, Josh. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner, will join us. And welcome back. This is the News Roundup on WCAI. I'm Sean Corcoran. And joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a reporter at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. During the News Roundup, we give you a glimpse at some of the news, the top stories of the week. Joining us on the phone now is Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Hello, Sally.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to hear your voice. Tell us about the police station in Provincetown. There's a building project, of course, going on. You're talking about it.
The beginnings of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this week, the Board of Selectmen decided they will ask town meeting voters in Provincetown for $42,000 to design a plan for how a larger police station would fit on the Shank Painter site. That's where the station currently exists. So, Sean, if you remember, initially, of course, Selectmen were hoping to build a new larger police station across the highway off Race Point Road, and that was on the DPW garage property. Mm-hmm. But many residents were adamant that they didn't want the police station across the highway. So then last fall, Selectmen were hoping to site the new police station at the former VFW property that's just off Shank Painter Road on the town side of the highway and on Jerome Smith Road. But town residents weren't ready to commit to that location either. Certainly it could have been partly because of the ongoing problems with the police chief at the time. So although one member of the Board of Selectmen described it essentially as wasting money on a study to tell us what we already know, suggesting that the building of the size that they need wouldn't fit there, the rest of the Selectmen and the Building Committee agreed that town voters need to see what a 13,000-square-foot station would look like.
Sally, wasn't that building bought specifically for a police station?
Well, from, yes, the selectmen's point of view, yes, that's what they were hoping for. But I think from residents' point of view, they decided that, well, they didn't really want to say yes to a police station there. They thought maybe they could put affordable housing there.
Oh, okay.
So, so I think that caused the selectmen to kind of withdraw an article to decide what or change the specification of what it would be. And just to buy that property rather than, say, for a police station.
Right.
So they figured they can compare what it looks like on the current site to what it might look like on the former VFW site on Jerome Smith Road. So it should be interesting. There's a lot of problems, including the size of it, because in order to keep parking on the site, you have to fit it into the same footprint. It's in a floodplain. So currently the very preliminary design shows a building that's raised 9 feet above street level with this very sloping drive, and that was in an effort to keep it in the footprint and keep the parking around it and because of the flood zone. So it should be interesting to see what it might look like.
All right, Sally, we'll be watching that. Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Thank you so much, Sally.
Thanks, Sean.
And Sean Gonsalves is with me here in our Woods Hole studio. Sean, there's a lighthouse for sale just down the road.
just down the road. It's not quite for sale yet, but they'd like to sell it. They'd like to get rid of it.
What are we talking about?
We're talking about the iconic Nopska Lighthouse just down the road, as you mentioned. And the Coast Guard, it's in the care of the Coast Guard. It has been for years. And now, though, they're in the process of going around to various properties, as a lot of federal agencies are, and looking for ways to become leaner and meaner. And this particular lighthouse has some maintenance issues. There's some repairs that need to be done that they think will cost about $500,000, and feel it would be better to sort of put it off onto somebody else. And so they're in the process of doing that. It's kind of a long process. It requires, under the National Historic Lighthouse Preservation Act, and this particular lighthouse is on the National Register of Historic Places. It was placed there in 1987. But under the National Historic Lighthouse Preservation Act, lighthouses have to be first offered to federal, state, local agencies or nonprofits. So there's that whole process. And then there's this process where if for anyone to take over the lighthouse, it has to pass muster with the National Park Service. And then if no agency or nonprofit sort of steps up to take it over, then it goes out to auction. Talking to Catherine Bumpus, the co-president of the Woods Hole Community Organization, she's pretty confident that it'll fall into good hands just because there are so many people as well as groups around here who really love this lighthouse. And in fact, there's already been discussions are underway with some local community groups to try to identify potential suitors for the lighthouse. So I don't think it's going to be sold anytime real soon, but essentially the Coast Guard would like to convey this lighthouse to someone else.
Right. And my understanding is the Coast Guard would still operate the lighthouse itself as well as the foghorn. And attached to this lighthouse or right next to it is a building, a home. I think it has been used by a Coast Guard official for many, many years. And so that building would be part of this deal.
That's right.
As well. Let's talk about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Wouldn't be a news roundup if we didn't touch upon the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station. Now, critics are hoping that they can make some legislative headway with this. And, of course, the problem when you talk about nuclear power reactors is they're federally run. The NRC runs them, and the states have very little say. So they're looking at now evacuation plans.
They're looking at evacuation plans. A lot of your listeners will probably recall several months ago there was this survey done that checked with people that lived on the Cape to find out if there were some type of radiological event or something, an accident, that sounds horrifying, but if there were something like that to occur at this plant, which, by the way, is very old, recently relicensed, would you have tried to evacuate the Cape? Now, apparently the plans, the evacuation plans, officially only covered this 10-mile radius right in around Plymouth. And I think they were trying to get a sense of if they had to evacuate within that 10-mile radius, what could they expect from people on the Cape who are just outside of that 10-mile radius? Would they try to evacuate? And I think some of the planning before assumed that not many people would try to leave the Cape, and the survey, of course, showed that actually just about everybody would try to leave the Cape. And in fact, as most folks would know who've spent enough time here, evacuating the Cape by automobile, going over the bridges, is ridiculous. I mean, it wouldn't happen. It would just be a mess. And so Representative Sarah Peake and the rest of the Cape delegation has been raising concerns about about the plant as well. But Representative Sarah Peake out of Provincetown is putting forward a bill that would require the Massachusetts emergency officials to reevaluate the evacuation and the emergency procedures that would happen in the event of an emergency. It's not really clear to me what that would mean because, again, in practical reality, you really can't evacuate the Cape. And I think but this is a way, they hope, of getting the company and state officials to wrap their mind around the big what-ifs and to really come up with a plan. And perhaps that might turn up the pressure on Entergy, who owns the nuclear plant, to maybe speed along what some people think is going to happen for economic reasons, which is eventually to close the plant.
Right. And one of the things they're talking about, well, as they say in the article, one of the big secrets, though it's not a secret, is they will likely, the plan is to close the bridges.
Because
you're trying to evacuate people from Plymouth.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to add all the people coming from Cape Cod heading towards Plymouth and heading towards the reactor. So they're trying to get, as you're saying, they're trying to get the state to play a bigger role, really take a serious look at this evacuation plan. Is there anything else we can do and not just limit it to those 10 miles, which I think just licks Sandwich at one point.
Right.
But Sandwich isn't even been involved in the discussions about the plans, which are regularly renewed. And I know that one thing they're really interested in doing is getting up monitors. So if there was some sort of release, getting some monitors in areas not just on the reactor site itself, but in surrounding communities, so you would know where are these particles moving,
right?
That type of thing. So we'll see. Like we said, it's the federal government holds on to those nuclear power plant issues pretty solidly. Let's talk about, since we're talking about bridges. A very interesting story in the paper today, which really talks about the most interesting part to me was the third bridge. There's been discussions about a third commuter bridge. Of course, there are three bridges now. One of them is a railroad bridge. So adding another bridge could really help with traffic issues, perhaps with evacuation issues. And it looks like they're taking it seriously.
They are really taking it seriously. I mean, they're coming up with the proposal. There's that that state commission, public-private partnership commission, that's going to be looking at this and issuing some kind of recommendation. Of course, the big thing with this is going to be the price tag. We're talking about $320 million. I mean, I think there's quite a bit of support for a third automobile bridge, because there are actually three bridges with the train bridge, but a third automobile bridge, which would run parallel to the existing Sagamore Bridge. And this really stems from, I mean, we've had some traffic nightmares around some holidays, and even in, not just in the summer, but even in the off season, and most recently around the Martin Luther King Day weekend, there was another real big traffic jam and backup up there. There's constant work that goes on there, and it, you know, because of the weather, sometimes work can't be done at certain times, you know, because people will raise questions about whether or not they could work at night, and there's all these things, and the bridges are so small with no emergency shoulders that it doesn't allow for crews to put their equipment on a breakdown lane or something. So whenever they're doing this type of work on the bridge, they're having to shut down a lane, and it just makes for what is already a bottleneck that much tighter. And the business community has really been out front on this issue, because it just affects, you know, the economy so much, and from a whole host and so they've been trying to open up communication between local transportation officials, local business officials that are on this transportation group, with the Army Corps of Engineer who controls those bridges, to see if there's a way, at the very least, to say on holidays, let's not do work on the bridge at all. And then also Tom Kehir, who in years past had been opposed to, in terms of before a bridge is built, they're also looking at some short-term things that might be done to alleviate some of the problems. Tom Kehir hadn't been a fan of this idea of closing that exit one, that little on-ramp that comes on right before the bridge.
Right before the Christmas tree shop.
Right before the Christmas tree shop.
Yeah, a lot of us sneak around on 6A and come up on that.
Exactly. That's exactly what I would do in many instances. But, of course, doing that, it breaks up the flow and it creates this backstop a lot of times. And so even Tom Kehir is now saying that he's starting to change his mind about whether or not that might be a good idea to temporarily close that exit one on-ramp during certain times to prevent that, you know, just so that there can be a better flow of traffic coming on and off Cape without, you know, these side distractions, so to speak.
And as you say, the Army Corps of Engineers maintains those bridges. And in some ways, that's a really good thing. As you hear about state bridges across the Commonwealth really being neglected, these bridges are not being neglected. They're constantly being worked on because they are older. So that is a good thing. But we'll have to see about a third bridge. And of course, how are they going to pay? How would they pay for that third bridge?
They're talking about tolls. And yes. not the old-fashioned sort of toll where you pull up and throw your money into the coin thing. They're talking about these electronic easy pass tolls, but there's a lot of details, I think, to work out on that in terms of if there would be exemptions for people that live on Cape and in the commute that they have, and how exactly that would work. But tolls would be the way to pay for this, and it's happened in other places, and that's why they're looking at that.
You've been on the Cape a long time. You were born on the Cape, or is that right? Or you came here from?
Yes, I mean, I was born here, but I was raised in California,
and then you came back. Mm-hmm. You've heard this third bridge be discussed before. Is this the closest we've ever been?
Oh, this is definitely the closest that we've been. I mean, for years they've talked about different things like a third bridge. They've even talked about tunnels. I mean, there's even been joke stickers, you know, for a tunnel permit. But this is certainly the closest that they've come And in fact, you know, to get the business community really behind this was a key part of this. And so this is certainly the closest they've come. But even in coming this close, it's still not something that's going to happen in the next year or two. There's a lot that would have to be ironed out.
One story we didn't get to this week is in regards to Striper limits, new Striper limits. So people, if they're interested in that, they should go to Cape Cod Online. I want to thank Sean Gonsalves. He's a columnist at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. He joins me in our Woods Hole studio. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
You can follow Sean on Twitter at Sean, GONCCT. Thanks to our other contributors, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We heard from Sally Rose as well. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.